Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The 2016 race for governor officially started earlier this month when House Speaker Shap Smith chose Main Street in Morrisville as the place to formally kick off his gubernatorial campaign.
I'm running for governor because the success of towns like Morrisville will be a vital part of Vermont's future. And because I want every Vermonter to have the opportunities and the choices that I've had. So together, we can build on this foundation, we can invest in our strengths, and keep Vermont a place where people want to live, work, grow up, and grow old.
Smith could face a crowded field in the Democratic primary. Former State Senator Matt Dunn is almost certainly running for governor, and Transportation Secretary Sue Minter is seriously considering entering the race. Why does Shap Smith want to be governor, and what does he see as the key issues facing the state of Vermont? Well, those are some of the questions we have today for Shap Smith. Speaker Smith, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
It's great to be here.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What do you think are some of the most important issues facing the state of Vermont that you want the next governor to deal with? Has the legislature done enough to reduce property tax burdens? If you don't think so, what should they do? And has the time come for a major restructuring of the state's income tax system? Your comments, your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Shap, as you decided to run for governor and you deliberated the major factors that you were considering, what kind of thoughts did you have? What were the major factors that came across your mind?
Well, you know, this is a really difficult decision on a personal level. I needed to make sure that my family, I've got two young kids, 13 and 10, a wife who works full time. I wanted to make sure that everybody was on board and that we could make the commitment that we needed to as a family. Those are tough discussions, and we had long conversation, and in the end, Melissa, my wife, and the kids were totally on board, and they thought that it was a great idea to run for governor. And I think you also, I think you have to ask yourself, do you think that you, as a leader, are someone who can make a difference? And here's the thing. I grew up here. I love this state. I've had incredible opportunities as somebody who went through the public education system, who went to UVM, who came back here in 1993, has been able to make a living and make an incredible life. And I want to make sure that all Vermonters have that opportunity to make a good living in the state of Vermont and make a life. And I think that when I look out at Vermont and the opportunities that we have, I'm really optimistic. And I think we can build on what we've already done and make this an incredible place to be.
You know, in your announcement, you said you wanted the state to be more of a partner to help restore downtown areas throughout Vermont. What specifically can the state do to promote stronger economies and communities all across Vermont?
I think when we look at what is going to make Vermont vibrant as we move forward, we need to build on the successes of communities like Winooski, that's done an incredible revitalization of its downtown, and Burlington. And part of what we've done to make those things successful is we've partnered with them as a state, where Winooski, we've given them incentives to finance infrastructure through the tax code. In places like Morrisville, where I live and where I was raised, and in southern Vermont, and places like Bennington and Brattleboro, we've been helping them out with downtown tax credits and innovative financing ideas. So we need to partner with communities, we need to partner with the federal government, and we need to partner with the state to make sure that we can create places that young people and old people alike want to be, want to stay, want to come to.
Shap, the Vermont Business Roundtable did a survey recently of businesses all across the state, the largest businesses across the state. These business leaders were cautiously optimistic about the future, but they had major concerns that lawmakers might enact some major tax changes during the 2016 session. Is that likely?
I don't think it is likely, quite frankly. When I look at what would be necessary to get us ready to make any substantial changes to the tax code, I don't think that we're there. You know, there have been conversations for years about whether we would do a major restructuring of the tax code along the lines of what was recommended by the Blue Ribbon Tax Commission. And I think at some point in time, we need to understand whether our revenue structure matches what our needs are for the state. And Vermont is not unique here. When I talk to friends and colleagues from around the country, they are all having real challenges and pressures caused by the fact that the economy is changing and revenues are not coming in the way that they expected under the old circumstances.
A lot of people would like to talk to you today, so let's start off with Paul, who's calling from Essex. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing today?
Great. What's on your mind?
So I guess my main concern or question was, it seems in general in Vermont that the cost of living is kind of on an upward trend, in particular in Chittenden County. And as someone who resides in Chittenden County, it seems at the same time that cost is going up, that jobs are more of a scarcity. And in particular, because there's such a high competition level, the pay for those jobs is also kind of, you know, going down or at least kind of staying where it's at, while the cost of living is rising. So I guess my question is, what's the best way to combat that? And then I do like have a plan of action as far as how we can go against that. And as sort of a follow-up to that, I noticed, you know, I have a lot of friends been out in Colorado, and I know ever since marijuana was legalized there, the economy seems to be doing substantially better. And is it possible that looking down that path could kind of help kickstart the turnaround so that we can, you know, balance things out as far as job opportunities and just the general economy of the state of Vermont?
All right, Paul, thanks very much for your phone call, Shap.
So I think there are two questions there. One, I think, was about the legalization of marijuana. And, you know, we have looked at this issue. It's clear to me from my discussions with Vermonters that, in general, the people in the state probably favor legalization. And I certainly believe that we can legalize marijuana if we do it right. And what I think we have an opportunity with is we've seen what has happened in Colorado and Washington, and we can learn from their experiences. So I can support and I will support a bill to legalize marijuana if we make sure that we have very strong protections for people who are driving under the influence to make sure that we can prosecute them. And as long as we make sure that we have laws that keep marijuana out of the hands of kids.
Is that what you mean when you say that Vermont needs to do it right?
I believe that Vermont really does need to do it right, and I think that we have the opportunity to learn from other states. And this is actually one of those times where I think it's a good idea that we weren't out front on this issue. It's pretty clear to me that states around Vermont are also probably going to legalize marijuana in the near future. I heard that there's going to be a referendum on the ballot in Massachusetts, likely a referendum on the ballot in Maine. I think there's indications there's support for legalization in both of those places. So I think that Vermont is likely to move along that trend as well. We just need to get it right, and I think we can.
Let's talk to Lanny, who's calling from White River Junction. Hi, Lanny. What's on your mind today?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Mr. Speaker, my question revolves around the fact that the previous governor has done a great job in regards to building industry in Chittenden County and up in the Northeast Kingdom as well as Jay. But down here in the Upper Valley, we're still lacking from growth. Along the Vermont-New Hampshire border, it's the old adage, people travel to New Hampshire to shop. And we need growth in the Upper Valley and the Lower Valley. And I was wondering what you can do to bring jobs back to the back door of, you know, Senator Dunn, who's running against you.
yeah.
Comment on that. It'd be great. Thank you.
You know, we have to make sure that all of Vermont is vital. If we only have one area of the state that is doing well and the rest of the state that's lagging, I think we have some real challenges on our hands. We need to leverage the growth that we have in Chittenden County. But when I look at places like White River Junction, Springfield, Brattleboro, Bennington, and Rutland, I see opportunities there. I've been down to Brattleboro recently. You see companies like New Chapter, Against the Grain. They're finding niches in the market. Against the Grain is this incredible company formed by a couple who didn't like the taste of gluten-free pizza and saw an opportunity to make gluten-free pizza that tasted good. And they're selling boatloads of gluten-free pizzas to Whole Foods, and they're at 75 or 80 employees now, where 10 years ago they didn't even exist. And it's, I think, encouraging companies throughout the state to find those niches, supporting them, and making sure that we're making the investments in the downtowns and the technological infrastructure that is going to allow those companies to grow.
Shap, we got this email from Fran, who wants to know and writes us, Shap Smith would win my support and my vote for governor if he would put his influence behind the carbon pollution bill introduced last year in the Vermont House. I've studied this bill very closely and believe it is a very good way to hold fossil fuel companies accountable for carbon pollution they put into the atmosphere. And at the same time, the bill returns 90% of the proceeds of the tax to Vermonters and holds low-income Vermonters harmless. Mm-hmm. What's the future of that bill?
So I've been pretty clear in the past that I would support a carbon tax at a national level, and I think that makes some sense. I've spent some time looking at the state bill. I think we have to build support from the outside before we move on that at the state level. I think that the offsets in the way that that bill has been structured could make sense over time. But I think that if we push it forward without the support of Vermonters, we're going to face a backlash that could cause it to be immediately repealed. And what I have been doing, and this is sort of the way that I like to work as a leader, is working with the groups who believe that this might be the right way to go or believe that this is the right way to go, and also talking to the people who have concerns to see whether where there are areas of agreement and build those bridges so that we can figure out where we have common purpose, how we could meet common goals to address issues around our revenue structure, but also address issues that are important in the long term, meaning reducing the amount of carbon that we produce as a state and as a country.
Let's talk to JT, who's calling from Morrisville. Hey, JT, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Kind of in a similar vein as that last question, I'm curious, Mr. Speaker, what you would do as governor to fight climate change, and if you're not supporting the carbon pollution bill, what would you do to fight climate change as governor, maybe specifically related to renewable energy development in Vermont and to keep the solar industry growing in state?
Yeah, I've been a very strong supporter of the renewable energy sector throughout my time in the legislature as well as the time as speaker. Here's the thing. It's been actually an incredible economic generator for the state of Vermont. We've created a lot of solar jobs. Per capita, we're number two in the country. We have been localizing the production of clean and green energy. And the local jobs, the jobs that we create, aren't just in the businesses that are selling the product, but they're the businesses like contractors that are installing the solar arrays, and installing other renewable energy. And we need to make sure that people feel like they have input on where the energy production is going to happen. And we have been making sure that we move forward with these renewable energy projects, but also make sure that Vermonters have a voice in the way that they are cited.
And what about that voice in the siting? What if a local community decides, you know, we really don't support this project? How much weight should that have?
Well, I think that this has been a challenge for infrastructure projects in Vermont throughout our history. Dams, highways, roads, bridges. And we have to, you know, the process for deciding where we're going to site energy projects and energy lines is the certificate of public good process. And we have to think both about the general public good, but we also have to have input at the local level. And, you know, we have tried to make sure that we reach the right balance there where people can have input in the process in front of the Public Service Board from the local level and also make sure that we're looking at the general public good for the state.
Today in the program, our guest is House Speaker Shap Smith. He's the first candidate running for governor. He announced earlier this month. Undoubtedly, there will be more. Your thoughts, your comments, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. With me today is House Speaker Shap Smith. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. If you've got a comment or a question, Shap, it seems that during this campaign that other candidates are going to hold you accountable for the action of certain issues by the legislature or perhaps the lack of action by the legislature. So let's take a look at a couple of those. Healthcare would certainly be one that will come up. Lawmakers really didn't do much last session to expand access to healthcare or to help keep the cost of private insurance down. This lack of action disappointed a lot of people who consider themselves to be Democrats, and they wonder, why wasn't the legislature more proactive on this issue? What's the answer to that question?
Well, I think that we ought to look at the good things that are happening in healthcare. We have one of the lowest uninsured rates in the country. It's somewhere around 3.6%. The trend rate for growth in healthcare has been coming down pretty significantly. We're at the cutting edge of payment reform, which will mean that we'll pay for performance rather than paying for the number of procedures. We're making real strides. That doesn't mean that we should stop trying to move forward. We know that for a lot of people, it still is really difficult to afford healthcare. And we made some efforts in the House last year to try to increase subsidies, increase reimbursement rates for primary care providers so that would bring down the cost of the healthcare insurance. And those items didn't go through. And I think we need to do more work there. And as Speaker this year, and if I'm elected governor, we would continue to address those concerns.
Let's also look at Vermont Health Connect. The Shumlin administration pursued the creation of a state exchange known as Vermont Health Connect with the full support of the legislature. You originally backed their approach, including a provision that made Vermont the only state in the country to mandate that all individuals and most businesses buy their coverage through the exchange. Now, the exchange has never really worked for businesses. They're now allowed to purchase their coverage directly from the insurance companies. There's still major problems with the individual market. I have a sneaking suspicion there are going to be people in this race who will say that you should share some of the responsibility for this situation and that you were too slow to challenge the administration.
Well, I think
how would you respond to that?
I think it's important to remember that we did actually believe that we needed to have an exchange. The federal law required that. And our choice was, do we want to go with the federal exchange or do we want to go with a state exchange that's going to allow us to help Vermonters have even more support for the cost of their health care? And we decided to go with the state exchange for that reason. We have been incredibly disappointed with how the exchange build-out has been executed. We have had huge problems there, and we have called the administration to account on that. And the question really for us now is if we can't make improvements, and we're cautiously optimistic that some of the work that's being done is improving the exchange, but if we don't meet the targets that were set in legislation last year, we're going to have to move in a different direction. I think what's often left out of the conversation is when I talk to people who are knowledgeable about this issue, it's not clear that it's going to be any cheaper or necessarily much better if we move to a different type of exchange. And it may be really problematic for those Vermonters who are now getting subsidies who might not be able to get subsidies for their health care under a federal exchange.
So it sounds like the next big timeline is October 1st for Vermont Health Connect to be able to deal with change of circumstance and people who will be enrolling in the new open enrollment period. If this thing isn't working the way it's designed to by October 1st, are you prepared to say that's it for the state exchange?
We are prepared. And what we're prepared to get and what the administration is supposed to present to us is what our alternatives are. And we need to vet those and make sure that if we're going to move to an alternative structure, it will be better than what we have now. I need to be convinced that that's going to happen, and I think legislators in general have to be convinced, because if we move from something that is sort of starting to work to something that's going to be worse for Vermonters just because, I don't think that's good for Vermonters.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Peggy, who's calling from Craftsbury. Hi, Peggy. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. Shap Smith, I would like to know what your plans are for reforming, restructuring, repurposing the PSB, the Public Service Board, because at this point, having gone through the Lowell Mountain issues and Sheffield, the PSB is not listening. You say you would like more public participation. Of course, so would we. But that is not happening, has not happened. And I would like to hear your thoughts about how to correct that situation. Thank you.
Well, we passed some legislation last year. First of all, thanks, Peggy. And we did pass some legislation last year that was intended to give people greater voice around energy projects in the process, the PSB process. I think it's important for us to see how that's working. And as we look at how that's working, we can make some changes along the way. What I have come to realize in my years in the legislature, in my years in Vermont, is that citing energy projects or big infrastructure projects is a difficult, difficult process that sometimes leaves some people unhappy. And the process that we have now is one that we need to continually look at and see if we can make Vermonters feel like they're better heard so that more people feel like what we've done is what the community wanted.
Let's talk to Bob, who's calling from Stowe. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi there. Regarding the important task of educating Vermont's kids, I've got no problem with the idea of bearing a tax burden equal to those Vermonters of similar means. But clearly the basic premise of Act 60 fails miserably in that regard, which of course why we have income sensitivity. But what, Mr. Smith, what would you support to bring equity for those of us who don't qualify for income sensitivity?
This year we passed an education reform law that was meant to address the equity of opportunity for kids throughout the state. And was also meant to create some administrative efficiencies that would bring down the cost of education or at least moderate it over time. And, you know, I hear from a lot of people who do not get income sensitivity how difficult their property taxes are. And if we had a silver bullet that would allow us to fix that situation, or we could wave a magic wand, I'd be the first one to do it. Because, you know, we as politicians don't like to hear people complain about their property taxes. It's, you know, it's a really difficult issue. So my feeling is for us to moderate on the revenue side, we have to look at the expense side. And I think part of that is trying to create efficiencies in our administration and also make sure that we have the right number of staff for the number of kids that we have out there.
There were some people, Shap, who looked at the education reform bill and said, you know, this is a great way to have greater educational opportunities for students, but that it was a mistake to look at it as a property tax reform plan. Do you really think it's going to save that much money and have an impact on property tax burdens?
I think over the long term, there is the possibility that it is going to save money because I think that it's meant to create some administrative structures that don't cost as much money. And I think that in the long run, it's going to allow us to create student-to-staff ratios that are more in line with what the rest of the country has. And in communities that are moving in this direction, so far largely in Chittenden County, you're seeing that they are getting lower tax rates.
Let's talk to Randy, who's calling from Essex. Hi, Randy. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a question on a similar vein. I mean, Vermont has one of the highest property tax burdens, highest cost per student in the country. We're only about 25th in income. And I've heard Mr. Smith say a couple times it's going to moderate over time. The restructuring is going to take time. And we understand that. But, you know, the schools my kids went to, which were great schools, now have about half the student population they did when the kids were there. Same number of staff. And this program is going to take ages, decades to kick into place. So what can be done other than towns just having to vote down their budget to get this under control so people like me can afford to stay here and not feel like we have to leave the state?
So, Randy, I think that's a great question. And we have a lot to be proud of here. We have a really good education system. On some measures, it is considered one of the best in the country and some measures one of the best in the world. We have great faculty. Our teachers should be commended for the job that they do. But we do need to recognize that we have 25 to 30,000 less students in a system that has close to the same number of staff and teachers. And we need to the number of teachers is going down, but I believe that the administrative changes under the education reform that we passed this year are going to mean that in the coming years, and it'll be the next 2 to 5 years, that you will see changes in the student-staff ratio and that you will see changes in the cost of education generally.
Shap, do you think we're going to see the 2016 legislature address the income sensitivity program and perhaps expand its eligibility?
Has been a subject of conversation in the House. The Senate has not been receptive to the idea. I think that it's a possibility, but I wouldn't bet a lot of money on it.
Let's talk to Peter from Brattleboro. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks. Shap Smith, we've had a lot of gun-related tragedies recently. In fact, I think there are around 30,000 gun-related deaths in the United States annually, roughly, and some of those have been in Vermont. If you are elected governor, what will you do to ensure that we have airtight background checks? And how will you exert leadership to actually make that happen?
Last year, we worked to pass legislation that would ensure that if you'd been convicted of a felony or you had been adjudicated as someone who is a harm to yourself or others, that you wouldn't be able to purchase a gun. You know, that was a very, very tough fought battle. And finally, we were able to bring some consensus around that issue. I think that what we need to spend a lot of time doing is working with people who are concerned about gun safety and people who are traditional gun owners to find areas of common ground where we think that we can make this a safer society. I am very troubled by the gun violence that we see and the violence that we see in general in society. And we need to make sure that we're moving in a direction that minimizes the amount of gun violence that we have, that also respects the traditional gun ownership in Vermont.
Do we need a stronger system of background checks?
Well, you know, many of the states where we've seen gun violence, it's not clear whether the background checks has helped that much. I think that the legislation that we passed last year was a step in the right direction. And I think that this is still a pretty divisive issue in this state. And my view is that we need to bring people together to see if there are areas that we can have common ground and move this issue forward.
Shap, we've got about a minute left. What would be the top priority for you for the 2016 session?
Clearly, the budget is going to be a top priority for the legislature. We know that we're going to have a difficult session ahead of us on the budget side. I want to make sure that we're continuing to make investments in infrastructure and Vermont's people to ensure that our economy gets even better.
And what do you say to those folks who think that the budget this year really took too much out of social programs when new revenue would have been a better approach?
This is always a tricky balance. Our revenues increased last year on the amount that we were collecting, and we did pass a revenue package. But I think that we have to recognize that we have a lot of needs, but we also have limited resources, and it's always a tough balance.
Well, in just a few weeks, it's likely we'll find out how many candidates will be running for governor. House Speaker Shap Smith, many thanks for being on the program today.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
Coming up next, I'll talk with former governor and former Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean about the dynamics of this year's race. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. We've had a number of big surprises so far in the 2016 presidential primary race. Many voters seem to be expressing great frustration at the status quo. In the Democratic race, Senator Bernie Sanders is drawing huge crowds with his populist economic message. And on the Republican side, Donald Trump is leading a huge field of candidates with his calls for new immigration policies and a free market solution to many of the country's problems. We thought this would be a good time to talk to someone who's been right in the middle of a presidential primary race. That's former Governor Howard Dean, who ran for president in 2004. Governor, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
And we should mention right at the outset that you are supporting Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. You know, my memory tells me at this point, Governor, in the Democratic race in the summer of 2003, you were on the cover of both Time and Newsweek. You had emerged as the front runner. I'm wondering, did this change the dynamics of your campaign? Did you become more cautious as you pulled ahead in the polls?
No, but we should have. I think being the front runner exposed a lot of organizational problems that you have when you go from nothing to the front runner. And we also had, I had a problem because I had run as an insurrectionist candidate and people don't elect insurrectionists as president of the United States. So although I was tapping into a vein of real discontent with the direction of the Democratic Party, not to mention the direction of the country, I wasn't able to capitalize on that in the way I would have liked to.
Is there anything you would change back in the summer of 2003 if you could?
Oh, sure, there's tons of things. But I think the probably the biggest thing of all was I was really trying to work towards becoming more sober-minded on the campaign trail. You know, the passion was incredible. It drew huge crowds, as it is for Bernie now. But I needed to not change the message at all, but I needed to change the way I delivered the message, and I just was not able to do that.
So as you mentioned, Bernie Sanders is drawing huge crowds this summer, 28,000 people in Portland, Oregon, 27,000 people in Los Angeles. There's no question that he is exceeding the expectations of many political observers, and he now poses a pretty serious challenge to Hillary Clinton. What do you think Bernie is tapping into? What accounts for his enormous success?
Well, you know, Bernie's message for 40 years has been one that is incredibly resonant in this campaign, which is we need economic justice in this country. And a lot of times in the past where people thought he's talking about the rich and the powerful and so forth and so on, there's always been some resonance with that in his races in Vermont. But now it's particularly acute, and not only does it resonate with progressive Democrats, it also resonates with conservatives, with Republicans who are not wealthy, working-class white Republicans. So I think it's a very powerful message, and I think that accounts for why he's doing as well as he is.
You know, Governor, a number of people think that part of Bernie's success is because Hillary Clinton has run a pretty lackluster campaign so far. She's not exciting the Democratic base, and she's failed to address the problems with her email server when she was Secretary of State. Would you agree with that?
No, I think the press is behaving in a way that I saw up close, which is another reason I didn't do so well. Once you're in the front, you can expect a withering blast from the press. The Republicans have been very skillful in taking advantage of a press corps that is sort of depleted both morally and financially, tends to take shortcuts. I would say about 90% of what is written about the so-called email scandal is either untrue or loosely related to reality. And this is going to go away because something that's not true. This is like Whitewater or the Vince Foster suicide, which there's a lot of conspiracy about, or Benghazi, which the departing Republican chair of the Intelligence Committee said was all hooey after he got out of office. It's a concerted and successful attack by Republicans simply because the press corps isn't doing their job. I think Hillary's actually run a very good campaign.
You know, Governor, there was a big story in the New York Times today. The headline is, Hillary Clinton's handling of email issue frustrates Democratic leaders. One of the people quoted is a former governor of Pennsylvania, Ed Rendell, who said, quote, they've handled the email issue poorly, maybe atrociously, certainly horribly. The campaign has been incredibly tone deaf, not seeing this as a more serious issue. So there's some Democrats who see this as a problem as well.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. I've been in this vortex. I've seen what the press does. We're not talking about everybody who's in the press, and I always make an exception to the Vermont press, because we all know each other, really. In Vermont, I found when I was governor, the press would discipline each other when somebody wrote a story that was ridiculous. Others wouldn't follow it. But in this era of get it first, don't worry about getting it right, or stories that are too good to fact check, that's the kind of stuff you get. And it happened to me. I remember one time as I was in Iowa at a Martin Luther King ceremony, the president came in, press corps came in and made so much noise, was disrupting the ceremony. So I left. They ran out, knocked down a congressman and an old lady, and created essentially a small riot. And then the next day the headline was, Dean creates riot at Martin Luther King ceremony. And that stuff used to go on all the time. So I don't have a lot of respect for the press corps in general nationally, and I think what you're seeing is not a fault of Hillary Clinton. What you're seeing is the press doing what they do. But eventually, the truth does out, and I'm not the least bit worried about Hillary's ability to win the nomination and win the presidency.
So Vice President Joe Biden is considering entering this race. If he does decide to run, how does that change the dynamics of this contest?
Nobody knows. There'll be lots of people who speculate, I think the speculation is just that, speculation. I don't know, think anybody knows where he gets his votes from, whether it's from Hillary or Bernie, maybe a little of both. He's a good guy. He's well-respected. He doesn't really have a constituency. And if you look at, which I think is the most extraordinary thing, here's a Democrat with pretty good, close to 100% name recognition, served for 7 years in an administration, which is still very popular among Democrats, and is in third behind Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders before he enters the race. And that's a bad thing, because usually the numbers go down once you enter the race and get subjected to all the negativity in the, the press swirl. So I just don't see his path to victory. But, he's a racehorse. He's always wanted to do this. He's done it twice before. He knows what it's about. I don't have a prediction about what he'll do.
Let's take a look at the Republican side of this. The latest polls show that Donald Trump has a comfortable lead over the 16 other Republican candidates. He's supported by roughly 30% of likely GOP voters. We were talking earlier about voter frustration with the status quo as being part of Bernie Sanders' appeal. Do you think the same thing is happening with Trump?
Well, I wouldn't want to compare Bernie, who I think is actually a serious student of policy, to Donald Trump. But Donald Trump is a very skillful person. I watched his live press conference a couple of days ago, and I have to say I was my jaw dropped. He managed to skewer Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and Chris Christie really seriously in front of his crowd in about 30 seconds. It was incredibly well done. So this is a guy who's on a roll. That's clearly buoying him. It'll be interesting to see what happens when things aren't going so well, and that always happens to every candidate, and see how he responds to that. But I would have to say that he is the big surprise of this election year season, and this is serious. And the question is, could he win? And the answer is yes, he could win the nomination. I never thought I would ever say that.
You know, I've seen a couple of articles in the last few days where some liberal Democrats are saying they like part of Trump's message, and that's the part where he constantly points out the danger of big money in politics and the destructive force of super PACs in the presidential campaign. Harvard Law School professor Lawrence Lessig, a leading proponent of campaign finance reform, wrote, quote, "Donald Trump is the biggest gift to the movement for reform since the Supreme Court gave us Citizens United. What he's saying is absolutely correct, the absolute truth. He has pulled back the curtain." Do you think Trump's strong criticism about the role that big money plays in politics has been a good thing for our political system?
I think it's a good thing that he's saying it, but I don't think he believes it. And if he thought it was a bad thing, he's a perfect example of somebody with huge money that if he didn't have big money, he couldn't be making this race. So, you know, it's a touchstone. Look, who knows what Donald Trump really believes? He has been all over the map ideologically. He has supported Democrats in the past. He has been pro-choice in the past, the recent past. So I think we don't really know what Donald Trump stands for. But I do think that he's effective and he has some real political skills that I think most people overlooked, including myself, when he first started.
Well, the first votes in this race will be cast in about 5 months. The Iowa caucuses take place on Monday, February 1st. We'll certainly be following this contest in the weeks and months ahead. Former governor and former presidential candidate Howard Dean, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Revolutionary War battles were accompanied by the simple music of wooden fifes and drums. The instruments are less in demand today, except among select audiences, like drum corps and war reenactors. Luckily for them, Cooperman Company of Saxton's River still produces fifes, drums, tambourines, and other musical instruments. The modern process of making period instruments is a blend of historical technique and modern machinery. Patrick Cooperman, vice president of the company, tells us more.
Field drums are used by ceremonial units in the military bands, as well as in reenactor groups, and in New England there are many, many fife and drum corps bands that are sort of town bands. At the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, the drum that's being played there is a Cooperman drum. So here in Vermont, the technology was about steam bending hard woods, all local native Vermont woods. We're needing to saw our own logs. We need very large trees that can be sawed into, say, a 20-inch deep shell. We walk the woodlots, bring them back here or to a local sawmill, saw the materials, and then steam bend them and work them right through to this finished product.
My name is Mike O'Brien. I'm mainly a tambourine maker, but I also float around the shop. Well, the thing that makes our tambourine special is the jingle slots. The bottom slot is a lot more narrow than the top, which allows the top to move more. And a lot of tambourines, the groove on the tambourines will be the same size for the top and bottom. So that gives it a distinct sound when you're going back and forth.
This is the original bending piece of equipment that was built in 1925 by the Cowing brothers. The factory was part of a farm, and these are parts from the washing machine, the ringers that were converted. So it's a wonderful old antique contraption. So we have everything from 1920s vintage piece of equipment made in-house to a CNC router, top-of-the-line technology for cutting our jingle slots. There's a large basket-making factory on the falls, just about a third of a mile down the stream from here. The factory burned down in the early 1900s, like 1908 or something like that. All the local people had that basket-making technology, but they had no jobs. And so the Cowing brothers decided, well, there's this big parlor music business. We know how to bend wood. We can make parts for that industry. And they started this. They really wanted to be dairy farmers. And so this building was built on the edge of their 150-acre dairy farm. The irony is that the dairy business didn't work out so well, but their little woodworking make ends meet part of their business actually survived.
That was Patrick Cooperman and Mike O'Brien of the Cooperman Company in Saxton's River. VPR's Rick Sengary produced that story. That's it for today. Coming up on Monday, how do you think the Vermont economy is doing? Different economic indicators, from unemployment numbers to profit reports to wages, can tell different stories. We're asking what your personal indicators are and how you see the state's economic outlook. Send your questions and comments to VermontEdition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sengary, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.